Thank you, Deborah. I'm happy to share with you today some of the results from CDC's National Survey on Maternity Care and maternity care practices and infant nutrition and care, what we prefer to call by MPINC because it's a little easier to say than all of that. I have no relationships to disclose at this related to this talk. Let me start off with a little bit of background about why we conducted this survey at CDC. We've known for some time that breastfeeding duration is much longer if an infant is not supplemented in a hospital. So in-hospital practices with regard to use of infant formula is a significant determinant of continuation of breastfeeding. A study published by Ken Rosenberg earlier this year documented the importance of commercial discharge packs in increasing the likelihood of supplementation at 10 weeks of age, with a 39% increase in that supplementation. The World Health Organization and UNICEF have for quite some time had an initiative to try to change practices within hospitals, known as the Baby-Friendly Hospital Initiative, and they've described 10 steps that are particularly important for getting off to a good start with breastfeeding in the maternity units. And a study just published earlier this month in Pediatrics documented that the more baby-friendly practices a woman experiences in her hospital stay increases the likelihood that she will be successful at breastfeeding, continuation of breastfeeding out for several weeks. So on the basis of a long literature that has documented the importance of hospital practices, CDC set out some years ago to find out what is going on across the country with regard to these practices. We called together a meeting several years ago to brainstorm what the right approach to this question would be. And the recommendation at that meeting and what we ultimately decided to conduct was a biannual census of all facilities that routinely provide maternity services. Biannual, because we didn't want to just have a single survey, here's what it looks like. We wanted to actually create what we're calling a surveillance system that we can track over time what is going on with these practices. We understand that there are a number of initiatives going on across the country to try to improve practices, and we need to have in place some way of tracking whether or not we're actually changing those practices across the country. A census for a number of reasons. We initially considered the idea of just doing a sample to describe the country as a whole. But what we learned at this meeting was that really many of the change agents for what is going on in hospitals are at the state level. And so the states individually needed to understand what was going on with the hospitals in their own state. And in order to have a large enough sample size to say what is going on within the state, for most states, you would have to actually go to nearly all hospitals. California and New York might be large enough that you could do a subsample there, but the rest of the states, you really had to do all of them. The second thing was that we felt it was useful not just to report these practices out at a national level, here is the overall picture of what is going on in hospitals, but actually to use the survey itself as a way to provide feedback back to each individual hospital about what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong. So we designed benchmark reports back to every hospital to report on how they were doing and where they can improve their practices. So we needed to have this census design. The design also consisted of anonymity. We felt that it was important that each hospital be able to respond to the survey in an anonymous way so that they would not be biasing their results so that they would look good in the press, that they could get honest feedback on how they actually were performing and how they should be performing. This has been a point of contention since the survey has been completed because many states and many coalitions and many individuals have wanted to know what the results were for a specific hospital to help them in making changes in that hospital. But we have had to protect the anonymity of the hospitals because of that. The other reason for maintaining the anonymity was that we wanted to get a high response rate. Traditionally, facilities are not very good at responding to surveys, and we felt that it was important in order to get a high response rate to ensure them that we would not be sharing their results with anyone else except in aggregate ways. I should point out that we ultimately achieved an 82% response rate in the survey that we were quite pleased with. The survey is designed to assess usual practice. We understand that there are policies in the facilities, and we did ask about those policies, but we're less interested in what they're supposed to be doing, but rather what they actually are doing. And we know that oftentimes that is not charted information, and so we were asking many subjective questions about what people think is going on in actual practice in their facilities. The questionnaire was designed largely around the baby-friendly 10 steps. It was implemented in August through December of last year. We continue to accept some responses into January for late responders. The survey was filled out by a key informant at each hospital. We identified this informant by a phone call to the hospital that described the survey and said, who is the person who is most knowledgeable about these practices in your facility? The survey was then completed either online or by mail. There were a total of 52 questions that they were asked. For those answers that we felt that they would have objective information and might actually know a numeric response to, we asked them numerically what percent of infants are cared for in a certain way. Many of the practices we understood are not typically charted in medical charts, and there are no statistics that they have, and so we were asking really more for a subjective assessment on a Likert scale, ranging from few to some to many to most of infants are cared for in this particular way. For some practices, we use a checklist of things that might be happening in the hospital. In analyzing the results, we broke them down into seven dimensions that largely follow the time frame of what goes on in the hospital or the birth centers. Labor and delivery. In the postpartum, we looked at three different kinds of issues: feeding of breastfed infants, breastfeeding assistance, contact between the mother and infant. Then we moved on to discharge care, and then we had two dimensions that were more global in terms of staff training and then structural and organizational aspects, kind of the policy issues for the hospital. So I want to share just a few of the results with you. First, we found in this survey that there are a number of inappropriate practices that are quite common, and they tend to be worse for C-section births than they are for vaginal births. We looked at skin-to-skin care. There were talks this morning about the importance of skin-to-skin care immediately following delivery. And we found that a third of the vaginal births are not experiencing skin-to-skin care, and over half of the C-section births are not experiencing skin-to-skin care. Significant concern here. Half of the facilities
reported that few or some of the mothers have skin-to-skin contact. Sorry for that unclarity. There is a difficulty in analyzing these that you often want to talk about the births, but in fact what you have are facilities reporting on the births within their facilities. I apologize. We also found that supplementation is much higher than we would consider to be expected on a basis of medical necessity. There are some reasons that some infants do need to be supplemented in the hospital, but those would be fairly low percentages. And what we found is that about a quarter of facilities in the country are supplementing over half of their births. If we use other cutoffs, we would get an even higher percentage than that, but we think this is really abysmal care that they would be offering supplements to over half of their infants that were breastfed. In terms of rooming in, we found that 24-hour rooming in is not standard practice at these facilities. Over half of the facilities said that less than half of their infants room together for at least 23 hours. However, while that sounds very poor, what we did find is that even in those facilities where they were not doing rooming in, most of the breaks in rooming in were fairly short-lived. Only 21% of facilities that were telling us that they did not have round-the-clock rooming in, only 21% of those said that the mothers and infants were separated during the night for more than 2 hours. So the babies were being brought back to the mothers during the night for feedings, and had so that the separations were fairly short. We also looked at reasons for separation between the mother and the baby, and found that there were many reasons being given for separation, and most of these are unnecessary.
If you can focus in on the yellow bar here in the middle, the transition to postpartum, that time when the mother is being moved from the delivery room into her postpartum recovery area, about half of the infants and mothers are being separated during this time period, or once again, I should say half of the facilities are routinely separating the mother and infant at that time. We also saw that there were many other reasons throughout the hospital stay where there was separation for the mother and infant. 86% of the facilities said that they separate them for heel sticks, 86% for hearing tests, 66% for bathing the infant. Infant photos, pediatric rounds, many reasons that the babies are being taken out of the mother's room. Then we looked at discharge care. And as I'm sure many of you are aware, discharge packs are routinely being given to mothers as they are discharged from the hospital. Our question is a little bit different than the way Ban the Bags campaign is asking this, because we're asking only about discharge packs being given to breastfeeding mothers. And about two-thirds of the facilities said that they are giving discharge packs that contain infant formula to mothers who are breastfeeding when they're discharged. We also found that in terms of discharge care, they are providing referrals to other facilities outside of the hospital. But most of these referrals are in the form of some kind of written information. They're often making referrals to WIC, but they're not making referrals back to the hospital for ongoing care with breastfeeding. And so only 31% are offering a return clinic visit to their mothers who are breastfeeding. Only 21% are making an outreach to the home to make a visit. About half of them are making telephone calls back to the participants. So there is an outreach, but not an actual face-to-face contact with those mothers. And so they're making referrals, but they're not using the kinds of referrals that are the most effective for providing optimal breastfeeding care. In terms of staff training, we found that training is much less than we would consider to be optimal. The Baby Friendly Initiative recommends that all nurses and those involved in maternity care should be getting at least 18 hours of training per year. So we asked for new staff, are they getting that kind of care or that kind of training? And 94% of the facilities reported that they were getting less than that. When we talked about continuous staff or staff that are not in new staff but ongoing training with them, we had a somewhat lower standard of what they ought to be expected to achieve each year. And so we asked, did they at least get 5 hours? And in this case, 75% of the facilities are not providing at least 5 hours of training on an annual basis. We also found that half of the facilities are not assessing staff competencies on an annual basis for their staff. So if we look across all seven dimensions, you can see here what their average score was. We gave a score on a scale of 0 to 100 for each of the seven dimensions about how they're doing relative to evidence-based care. We found that they had particular difficulties in the area of discharge care and staff training. Then when we averaged across all seven dimensions, we created a composite score, and overall across the nation, the composite score was 63. That has been reported in the press as being an F. I'll let you be the judge of whether our hospitals are getting an F. We also looked state by state to see what the patterns are of how they're doing on their scores. And not too surprisingly, we found that those states who typically have the highest rates of breastfeeding initiation and exclusivity and continuation out to 12 months are also the states that are doing the best with regard to their maternity practices. So to summarize a few of the points today, most facilities do not provide adequate post-discharge care. Majority of the care that is being provided as discharge is passive care, and it is written information that is being provided to the mothers. It's not active referrals or active care. We found that far more breastfed infants routinely receive supplemental feedings that could be justified by any kind of a medical need. We found that the facilities reported numerous reasons for routine separation of the mother and infant throughout the hospital stay that begins in the very first moments of life. And we found that the distribution of formula marketing samples to mothers is pervasive across all geographic regions. So where do we go from here? want to just comment on a few of the initiatives that are underway to try and change hospital practices. First of these is just to educate facilities about what the problems are. The results of this MPINC survey are one example of how we are doing that, telling the facilities what are the aspects of their care that they are doing right now that are not evidence-based. There are many other efforts underway, such as the Ban the Bags campaign and lactation consultants working within hospitals, physicians working within hospitals, trying to educate about what evidence-based care is and change those practices. We also have initiatives to try and recognize those facilities that are doing an excellent job. The Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative is a key example of that. When a hospital is doing all of the right things and can be demonstrated to be doing that, then they can be designated as being baby friendly. Get a plaque on the wall, make that well known to their media, and really raise the flag that they are doing excellent work. States are also engaging in finding ways to acknowledge hospitals that are doing a better job. The Texas 10-step, for example, acknowledges hospitals on a basis of self-assessment of their practices as to how they are doing better and recognizes that excellence. Another example is trying to get better oversight by regulatory agencies. Most importantly is the Joint Commission that provides the accreditation of healthcare organizations. And every hospital is very concerned about making sure that they do get accredited by the Joint Commission. We are trying to work with Joint Commission to get them to put this on their standards of what is expected in every hospital that they do accreditation in, that they would be looking out for these kinds of evidence-based practices. Public reporting of what is going on in hospitals. California has been reporting on rates of exclusive breastfeeding by hospital and comparing that to rates of initiation by hospital to demonstrate what are the hospitals that are not performing up to standards. Those kind of data could be shared more generally across the country. The National Quality Forum has proposed an indicator of exclusive breastfeeding that all hospitals would have to report or be expected to report as part of their perinatal standards. This kind of public reporting of what are the hospitals that are doing a good job and those that are not could go a long way in getting hospitals to strive toward higher rates. Pay for performance is a way to increase the reimbursement for hospitals that are doing a good job or decrease the reimbursement for hospitals that are not doing a good job. So there would be different standards in Medicaid for how much they would be reimbursed for each birth on the basis of how they do on these evidence-based practices. There's an initiative before APHA to sponsor that kind of policy. And there's a growing effort to try and make that standard for Medicaid and for third-party payers. Finally, establishing regional collaborations or collaboratives where states or elements within a state, regions within a state, would try to get hospitals to work together to try to move their practices toward more evidence-based practice. Just want to acknowledge the many collaborators that made this survey possible. Many people at CDC actively engaged in that, particular Catherine Sheely, who has sponsored this from the very inception out to getting these reports out to the hospitals within the last few weeks, and many excruciating steps along the way. Also thanks to Deborah D., who published an MMWR on this back in June. There are copies of that MMWR up here for anyone who would like a copy of that report. Thank our collaborators at Battelle who actually carried out the survey. Jennifer Cohen is in the audience here today. And many consultants that we've had at various aspects of designing this and getting the results out with everyone. If you want more information, you can go to our overall website at cdc.gov/breastfeeding or information about the survey itself on cdc.gov/mpink. Thank you.
Medical students and physicians, you know, in maternity and newborn care.
We did not have a separate section on the questionnaire to ask about what they were doing in terms of education. We do have an indicator about the characteristics of the hospitals, and so we are able to analyze them separately by those that are teaching hospitals. But the questionnaire is the same for all facilities. It sounds like it's the same issues that other hospitals have, but they might have different reasons for it. And like I say, we could tease out, analyze the data by teaching hospitals versus non-teaching hospitals. Say something. Kat is suggesting that I also mention state reports. We are in the process of designing reports that would go to every state health department so that they can understand what is going on with the results in their states. The MMWR that we released in June gave state-by-state overall scores but didn't go into the specifics of the practices that are going on in each state, and we're working on getting those reports out now. We don't have anything formally. The question was, have we built in an evaluation component to evaluate the impact of the reports themselves? We don't have anything formal at this point. We are planning for a new survey at the end of 2009, and so we will be considering what new elements ought to be put in there. We certainly could consider something like that at that point. But in terms of an overall evaluation, we don't have anything formally planned at this point. Mm-hmm. Yes, Anne. We certainly did, and I'm trying to remember all of the details, all the different aspects here. Overall, if you look at the total score, it really could not be any flatter than we found. There is no difference by size of facility in their overall score. But that hides the fact that the subscores do differ on several of the elements. Where the larger facilities are doing much better on some components and much worse on other components. And so it's when you average those together into this overall composite that it washes out any effect. And I apologize, I'm forgetting the details right now. If you want to come up afterward, I can look those up.
In staff training and infrastructure, the bigger facilities do better. It's really not too surprising when you think about it. And then the bigger facilities did worse on at least two of the postpartum indicators, the contact and the assistance, I believe, which, again, not too surprising. And then with some of them, there was also delineation of facilities that were 250 or less versus everyone else. So basically, birth centers and everyone else.
Yeah, thanks. Yes. There are lots of them, and I'm sure several people in the audience would be happy to comment on some additional ones. I'm going to start with free formula coming into the hospital being a significant barrier to change. this is a financial incentive that many hospitals, I forget the exact percentage, but the vast majority is 88%, does that sound right, are receiving their formula for free from infant formula companies. And so they get not only the free formula, but they get the influences that come along with that. You know, we're all starting off our presentations with our financial disclosures. Well, there's a financial disclosure about the practices that you decide to do and who are the people that are advising you on those practices. There are certain things that the formula companies insist upon as part of their contract to provide that free formula. One of those is the discharge packs for most facilities. And so it's a very difficult practice to change when it's attached to a financial incentive. There are also structural structural barriers in terms of we've always done it this way. And so there's a momentum. We know how to provide this kind of care. Things work for people to think outside the box and say, well, now if we provided these services a different way, could we still get our work done? There's some of it is convenience. You know, as she was just talking about the teaching facilities, it's a lot more convenient for a pediatrician who can have all the babies lined up and go through and do all of their vitals on 10 babies in a row, they're done and they move out of the hospital, rather than having to go to each of the separate mother-baby wards and talk to the mother and do all of that there. It's a less efficient process in that regard. We would argue it's much worse care, but it's an efficient way of moving through. So those are some of the key barriers I would comment on. I'm sure there are many others as well. I think it was 88% in ours. Why the difference? You know, it's always hard to know exactly the reasons there. There's also reduced cost formula that some hospitals might be dealing with, and so they, I think we asked about free, they might have been getting reduced cost, and that's part of the contract that they have as well. In the back here, Ken? It's all in how the contract gets written, I'm sure. And they still want to be doing their marketing one way or another. Wrap it up. Or take one more question back here. As I said, many barriers.